KPBS On Demand is supported by UC San Diego Art Power, presenting Dream Like Taylor, a live band journey through the enchanted eras of Taylor Swift featuring Cassie B on July 12th at the Epstein Family Amphitheater. Tickets and the complete summer lineup at artpower.ucsd.edu.
Welcome in San Diego, it's Jade Hindman. On today's show, we're talking about foraging, the act of searching the land for sources of food, and we'll talk about the history and the culture behind it. This is Midday Edition, connecting our communities through conversation.
KPBS On Demand is supported by UC San Diego's Art Power, inviting you to experience the science of story. 6 days of programming celebrating how and why we tell the stories that move us from July 23rd through the 28th at UC San Diego. Events include Clarion Writers Masterclass, A Tale of Two Sulus, An Evening with George Takei and John Cho, Star Trek in Concert with the San Diego Symphony, and more. For information, visit artpower.ucsd.edu.
In an age of supermarkets and takeout, it might seem unusual to go out in nature and pick food. But the act of foraging is actually becoming more popular. That's the practice of gathering plants, fruits, and fungi, and you can forage for many things beyond just edible food. We want to pull up the roots on foraging, talk about where it started and what it is and why it's a great way to reconnect with nature. I'm joined now by Pascal Gagneau. He's an evolutionary biologist and a professor at UCSD. And Professor, welcome.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
So glad to have you here. I hear your interest in foraging started in childhood. Tell me about that.
Yes, I grew up as a city kid. I was lucky to have a grandmother who lived in the mountains and knew a lot about wild edibles. She was also a gardener. But every summer, I would go and visit her for 6 weeks at a time, and we'd harvest dandelions and stinging nettles and chanterelles and chestnuts and all kinds of things.
Wow. I mean, it can be seen as kind of a novelty, but it's actually 1,000 years old, this practice is. Tell me about that.
So my interest is in human origins. So obviously, it's not lost on me that humans as a species have been around for about 300,000 years. And farming is younger than 10,000 years. So that means for the vast majority of all our ancestors' existence, they started every day asking themselves, what will I find today that I can eat? And in a way, there is some resonance in that even though I shop at various supermarkets, most of my food, I do garden, but that's just for fun. There is a special joy in finding things that you can eat that seem safe, away from dogs and pollution and pesticides and so forth. So you have to think about where you pick things and know where not to pick things. Mm. But so far, it's mostly been very pleasurable. And as a teacher, of course, it's a fantastic opportunity to convey all kinds of concepts to my undergrad and graduate students alike.
Mm-hmm. For yourself, when learning what to eat and what not to eat, how was that trial and error?
So it's not so much trial and error. I do what humans do best is we share brains, right? We have language, unlike our ape cousins. They have communications, but they can't really tell stories. So my grandmother could show me and explain to me in words how to pick a stinging nettle without being stung. A chimpanzee would have to do trial and error because chimpanzees don't teach. So a lot of what I've learned studying botany, and I'm a biologist by trade, a zoologist, but I consider animals highly concentrated plant matter because all animals eventually rely either on another animal that ate plants or they directly eat plants. So I've learned a lot both in my studies and through friends and family about what is edible and what not. And then when you have a certain sense of botany, you also start recognizing families like the spurges that are, you know, almost everything in the spurge family is highly poisonous. So then you're a bit more careful and you read up. If you don't know the plant, you ask your friends who are botanists or horticulturalists or farmers. And these days with Google and Wikipedia, you can do quite a lot of checking. So, yes.
This is true. It's a lot. Yeah, yeah. All the answers that you need are right at your fingertips, it seems. You've actually bought a couple of things that you foraged here just this morning. What do you have? It's a big basket that you've got, and I see all sorts of colors. And it's pretty fragrant, too.
So your team reached out to me and asked, oh, is it possible that you could bring something? And I got that email yesterday, but I only paid attention to it this morning. So, okay, let me jump on my bicycle. And then I put a pannier in the back of my bicycle to collect things. And I started one block at a time from my home. And the first thing I collected were a couple of these bean-like things that are now, they're not completely mature, but they are called carob, carob trees. They are from the Mediterranean, and they're really interesting because you can make a type of fake chocolate from carob powder. And so they're actually really nutritious pods that have little seeds, and the seeds are themselves very interesting because the word carat comes from the carob seed. The species name is Ceratonia or Keratonia siliqua.
And it grows on?
It grows all along the roads of L.A. and San Diego. It's a very interesting tree that has male trees and female tree. That's relatively rare. And the flowers are pollinated by flies, which is why it makes a scent that is not very pleasant and that I cannot describe on the radio for fear of...
Okay.
So if you, everybody has noticed these trees when
a
they bloom.
A sewagey kind of scent?
Let me put it this way. One of the components the flowers produce is called spermidin.
All right.
We can leave it at that.
All right. Well, but it does make a chocolate substitute. Does it at least taste like chocolate?
The carob I have tried, I'm a Swiss chocolate snob,
so I would say
no, it's not chocolate, but it's very tasty and it's nutritious. It turns out there is a polysaccharide in this pod that has been almost depleted by the fracking industry because when they frack for gas, they have to inject a fluid that holds the pressure in the rock that they crack. And so they extract a polysaccharide that makes an emulsion, a very thick goop. So they've actually used a product from this pod to extract gas, and they still are using it, which is remarkable.
Wow, very interesting. I mean, it seems like there are just so many purposes for foraging. You can even make things, right? Like what you just said.
Yes, I brought a couple of ropes. So a cordage, which is making rope with plant fiber, is fascinating because it's a very old technology that, of course, we have no idea how old it is because it doesn't fossilize. So if you think back, you know, in the last 2 million years, our ancestors miniaturized their body hair. All of us still have hair follicles all over our bodies. But compared to a chimpanzee or another great ape, we don't have enough hair for infants to hold on to moms. So I would argue the most important tool in human evolution was the baby sling, which you could make with an animal skin, or if you don't have an animal skin, you make fiber and then you macrame something like a bag or a little hammock, and now you can carry your infant, which people all around the world used to do until very, very recently. These days, we're rediscovering the advantages of carrying your infant around, both for dad and mom. Of course, dad cannot breastfeed.
Well, you teach a course at UCSD about, you know, the evolution of the human diet.
Yes.
What does that course entail?
So... My goal with this course is to use food, which is such a beautiful in for most people. You know, I had a professor in Switzerland who talked about the fact that love goes through the stomach. There's very few people you cannot reach via food. And humans are, we stand out because we have become addicted to cooking. All human societies cook their food, even people in the high Arctic who have no fuel. They have a little bit of driftwood, but they actually use animal fat to make a flame, and then they cook their food over that. And so the idea that humans use a cultural invention, cooking, that has now become a biological necessity is incredible. So food is, it puts biology and genetic evolution and cultural evolution together, you know, in a very, very intuitive way.
All about the evolution. That's so fascinating, and fascinating that you're able to sort of to tie culture and human evolution in with foraging. I mean, that's an interesting lens to look at it through.
That's the starting point. Of course, where I aim to go is talk about all the things that are wrong with food now.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that, you know, the U.S. went from 30% obesity to 42% obesity in 10 years. It's the first time in the history of our species that we can eat all the time. And you know, we're told what to eat all the time, and you know, PR works. And something like a potato chip, it just hacks your brain. There is no way I can put down a bag with a potato chip. And if I'm watching TV and eating it, by the time I'm done, I don't realize I inhaled a whole package, right? Because it's the tooth feel is fantastic, the fat is there, the salt is there, the umami flavor is there. So it's a huge problem. We have to eat. You cannot. It's not like tobacco, right? You can live without tobacco, but you cannot live without food. But now we all swim in it, and we have to reconsider our relationship with food. So obviously, a big part of that class is, how can we help each other find a reasonable way of, you know, eating socially, sharing meals, spending a lot of time thinking about what we prepare, preparing it together, using ingredients that are healthy rather than just, you know, stopping at an In-N-Out or another fast food and inhaling a burger going 65 miles an hour on the highway.
Well, let's get into that more, because sure, there's the availability of food. That's one issue. But the other issue is how our bodies are metabolizing and processing the food that's on the store shelf or in a fast food joint. There's a lot of additives. There are a lot of chemicals. And can you call it food? And how does the body react to that?
No, that's a really important question. On the topic of chemicals, you know, every food by definition is chemical, right? Because all these plants are made up of molecules. And so chemicals are not bad as such, because you need to eat all the chemicals that you find in healthy natural food. When you mention chemicals, you probably mean things like preservatives and things that are not really foods, but they're added to these highly processed foods, for example, to make them easier to pump and fill into your little portions.
Or high fructose corn syrup.
Absolutely, okay. Which allowed the U.S. to free itself from sugar cane sugar using the excess corn. So what you say is a huge issue in terms of, is the food that our kids and we eat now, how is that even like the food that our great-grandparents were eating? And there's probably a safe argument to be made that eating more like your great-grandparents is likely to be healthier than to consume all your food from ultra-processed packaged stuff that you have a minimum connection to. You don't know where it comes from. You spend zero time preparing it. You just pop it in the microwave or, you know, have a takeout or something like that. So I'm a big advocate for, don't eat foods that have more than 10 ingredients, and cook foods that you put at least 10 different things in, because then it won't be just the same stuff.
Well, do you hear from your students about maybe who have actually tried foraging and perhaps they felt different after foraging, or they, you know, I mean, and what about yourself? How do you feel after you've had a meal that you foraged?
So I rarely have meals that I entirely forage. The foraging is really for fun, for the thrill of discovering something cool.
Yeah.
I prepare most our meals at home for my family from scratch. I don't like to use mixes, and in fact I have a mill that is on my kitchen island where I grind my own grain. Not because I think it's necessarily healthier, but it makes really tasty bread. If you take rye and emmer and different grains and use some of the grain in the bread freshly ground, it just tastes wonderful. Back to the students, what I have heard from several students, especially after COVID, because I've been teaching this class for 8 years now, is several students have contacted me and said, oh, Pascal, you know, you really saved me, because I started cooking after I took your class, and that saved me during the COVID. So that warms my heart.
Oh, that's excellent. Well, I mean, say someone is interested in foraging. What advice do you have for them? Like, you know, are there certain plants they should avoid, certain areas they should avoid? Or...
Almost certainly, yes. And the first thing to avoid is if you know that people walk their dogs there, it's probably better not to collect anything that is from a height lower than a dog can lift their leg. And another place to avoid is probably along really busy freeways, just because of all the pollution from traffic. Another problematic area is in wetlands. If you had floods and sewage spills, mm-hmm. that would be extremely dangerous to collect things that you then eat raw. So you're safer with things that are higher up, trees, fruit. But there are plenty of like green leafy things that are higher, like this Brussels sprout I found in La Jolla this morning. There's enough leaves there, you can, you know, you make a beautiful meal of chopped, you know, like collard greens or something like that. You saute that in a wok with some mushrooms or some tofu or some meat if you'd like. There are just so many plants. My goal was to, you know, collect at least 100 different edible plants between my home in North PB and UC San Diego. And so on my webpage, I have a collection. I just reordered them. I put the native plants first. And so I have something like 15 native plants. Uh-huh. And then the other 85 are from all over the world. Yeah. They're from places that have cold oceans and a hot inland, like southern South America, Western Australia, and South Africa. Yeah. And there's so many of them.
I've been speaking with Pascal Gagneau. He's an anthropology professor at UCSD. Pascal, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Jay.
And if you want to find out more about all the things you can forage, go to kpbs.org. Coming up, more on the cultural practice of foraging.
How I view foraging is being present with the plant relatives, all the plant trees, the fungi kingdom, and the spirit world at the same time.
Midday Edition is back after the break.
KPBS On Demand is supported by UC San Diego Extended Studies, inspiring ordinary people to dare, dream, and do. Online videos of dreamers sharing their real-life stories, along with courses, certificate programs, and more can be explored at extendedstudies.ucsd.edu.
You're listening to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. The act of foraging might be gaining some steam in the mainstream, but the Kumeyaay people have been doing it for thousands of years. Paul Cannon joins me now. He's a medicine maker and member of the San Pascual Reservation. He's foraged for many years. Paul, it's great to have you here.
Hauka, mayutumawa. Thanks for having me.
So glad you're here. So I mentioned you're a medicine maker. Tell us what that means and how foraging complements that.
You know, when you're a part of a tribe, a people, a village, a circle, everyone kind of has a role. For me, medicine, through my music, through using sage, making tinctures, topical balms, using native plants, using plants to heal my babies, to heal other babies. Someone that's just kind of intuitive. I'm intuitive with the spirit world, with the plant world, and how to bring the spirit world to this physical medium.
That's great. I mean, foraging is a longtime tradition for the Kumeyaay people. Can you tell me about some of those practices?
You know, something about foraging before Western civilization, that's just what we had around. You used what you got. You got plants, you got trees. For every illness, there's a plant that can cure it. So in this immediate region that we inhabited, that's just the natural progression. We would use the oak to build, use it for food, use it for shelter. So foraging is like one part of a greater picture of just embodiment with nature. So how I view foraging is being present with the plant relatives, all the plant trees, the fungi kingdom, and the spirit world at the same time. So what that looks like in specific terms today is identifying the plants off the freeway. I could tell you which plants are native and not native. Native plants, meaning they use less resources, less water. They work in union. So those ones, they also have benefits. Every time there's a colored flower, that means there's some part that you need that flower, and it's going to activate a certain part of your body that you might need. So the flowers speak to us, but if they're native, they'll speak to us at the right time when we need something for our body.
Yeah. Well, walk us through a typical day of foraging.
It depends where I'm at. I was in Manhattan doing an art demonstration with the Guggenheim. I can find stuff just growing on people's balconies. When I'm in my foothills on my reservation, it's mostly native plants. There's some naturalized plants, but what it looks like is a divine communion. So recognizing all the properties and the principles and the complicated details that are there that I don't understand allows me to hold like this superior reverence for everything that's greater than me that I don't control, which is pretty much everything. I don't control much. So foraging looks like not am I only going to pick berries in the right time and season, not only am I going to Palomar Mountain to get the best acorns that are the biggest and the largest, have the most fat, it's a relationship. It's a journey. Like every footstep I take there, I'm walking deeper into a connection. It's like going to my grandma's house. And so it'd be like saying, I just go to my grandma's house and I take a cookie. It's way deeper for Indigenous peoples of recognizing that like it's a connection. And so you go to refill not only your basket, your physical basket, but your emotional cup, your physical cup, and your mental cups as well by being in relationship. So for me, it's seasonal. Right now, you know, I grow sage and mugwort year-round. I'll use sage if I get sick, if I get congested. So I will just go and pick sage in safe harvesting areas that our reservations planted or in my garden where I grow it. So foraging is also like, oh, I need this. So it's kind of like shopping, but it's a more conscious way of doing it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, a lot of the plants that you're harvesting or foraging are for healing. You mentioned sage and mugwort. Anything else that you forage for those purposes?
You know, a nice one is elderberry. You can use it in so many ways. So say, you know, my child's sick, elderberry syrup. Say I want to make some pancakes. I can use that syrup on there. It has antioxidants. I forget the other terms or the other things in it. I'm not a scientist, but what I do know is that this tree is the tree of music as well. So the branches are hollow. Coco Pelle would use that tree and make flutes out of it. So you can make a flute while you're getting some berries. And the flowers, if you make a tea, there's just so many things you can do with it. Menstrual cramps, emotional fatigue, just boosting your immune system. So that one's really fun. There's a lot of versatile plants. You're like, oh, I didn't know you could use this.
How do you use sage for colds?
So with black, you want to use black button sage. And as a disclaimer, sage in the state of California, you're not really, it's like an endangered species. You're not really supposed to be out there publicly foraging for it. It's illegal in the eyes of the state. So I'm speaking as an Indigenous person that we do have our own nation. We do have our own governance. And we do our best to be good relatives and allies. So what I do with the sage, the black button sage, is you want to steep a couple leaves. With most medicinal plants, if you take a couple leaves and you steep them for a few minutes, you drink a cup of tea 2 to 3 times a day for 2 weeks, you can clear up so much stuff in your body. It's a diuretic. It's an antifungal. It's an antibacterial. So if you're struggling with infection, bacteria, you know, what's happening in Western society is that the food we're eating is dead. So we end up becoming dead. And taking active plants, drinking a nice native tea allows us to come back to life.
Do you think there's a misunderstanding about the cultural significance of some of the plants you forage?
I think there's a lack of education, yes, most definitely. It is, you know, things that are sacred and unique to specific cultures, like my culture, Kumeyaay culture, they're prized and they're kept in the family, in the circle. So there is a lack of understanding and education. So that may turn into what could look like abuse or misuse or appropriation. But I wouldn't go as far to say that people have an ill intention by utilizing a sage bundle, by using an abalone shell, or foraging for native plants. I think no man owns the earth. We're all part of it. We're all here together. And if somebody wants to learn and improve or heal, I think it's our duty to educate, inspire, and connect.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious, how has colonization impacted the practice of foraging?
You know, the laws today don't allow people to really forage. Like I just said about sage, it's interesting, especially in San Diego. It can feel like, where can I go to be free on the land? I don't know. I know from my personal experience, if I want to just go freely walk on some property, I have to go to a park that's organized by the state, by the federal government, by like all these things. There's so much red tape, and for good reason. We have a lot of people in this city. And that is colonization. When you remove the connection to the land, when you separate the grandchildren from the grandparents, when you separate the people from their resources, what we call resources today, then people become dependent on a system, on a Western system that's designed to keep you dependent and addicted. So the options to go forage freely are extremely limited. But if you're wild like me and a rebel, hey man, we live once. Like no one's gonna catch you if you're respectful and use some plants. And the most responsible way now is to grow your own, just like cannabis. Another thing people don't recognize is if you stop off the side of the road to go forage, you might be getting a ton of pesticides from the city because they just drive and spray the whole side of the road. So you never want to do that. So I would say colonization is just limited. It limits access today and drastically.
And so now you've actually thought about teaching others about foraging, in particular edible foods. What made you want to do that?
You know, I'm a citizen of the world. I love other people. I love that people have a desire to learn. So do I. I'm both sides of the fence. So, you know, I'm native and I'm American. And I have a lot of relatives and family that are not native. And you know, I don't want to shun people. I don't like it when people kick me out of things or make me feel excluded, which they don't make me, but I can feel excluded. So it's just a part of my heart. It's part of my, just me. I want to give, I want to educate, I want to expand people's consciousness, awareness, so that they avoid more suffering. I think we all would like that.
Yeah. Well, for those who might be interested in foraging, what do you want them to think about as they start that journey?
Seek wise counsel. You know, it's wonderful to be curious. And if you come with an open heart, people, they'll educate, they'll love on you, they'll send you in the right direction. And I would highly encourage people to get closer to the plant kingdom, into the other kingdoms of this world that maybe we ignore or we're too distracted. And I think the gateway to that, the gatekeeper, is the plants. It's everything that's around us. They're everywhere. And once we learn the difference between natives, non-native plants, like why are they called that? The benefits of native fruits, different root vegetables that grow wild, different grapes. We have tons of native grapes around here. It's you just start tripping out. You start going in a different direction. It's really good for the brain to have both sides, to get closer to nature in a respectful, honorable way, and to still do the 9-to-5 grind or whatever it is we do. So I would say just add it in.
Great advice. I've been speaking with Paul Cannon, medicine maker and forager and member of the San Pasqual Reservation. Paul, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. And if people want to get a hold of me, they can go to paulsagecannon.com and they can find more about me, my mission, and my music.
That's our show for today. I'm your host, Jade Hindman. Thanks for tuning in to Midday Edition. Be sure to have a great day on purpose, everyone.
KPBS On Demand is supported by UC San Diego's Art Power, inviting you to experience the science of story. 6 days of programming celebrating how and why we tell the stories that move us from July 23rd through the 28th at UC San Diego. Events include Clarion Writers Masterclass, A Tale of Two Sulus, An Evening with George Takei and John Cho, Star Trek in Concert with the San Diego Symphony, and more. For information, visit artpower.ucsd.edu.